Right. So, for the sake of the recording, we're going to call this talk Hinayana and Mahayana, two aspects of our practice. So, Theravada is the modern extant form of Buddhism, which at least aspires to be as close to original Buddhism, you know, so what Buddhism looked like when the Buddha was alive, what his teachings and practices. So, you know, there's some question about exactly, you know, how true to the original that is, and how are you sure this text is part of the canon or whatever. But I mean, that's their aspiration, right? Their aspiration is to stay true to the canon of what the Buddha taught. When the Mahayana arose, which really ended up being many branches of Buddhism, like further evolution of Buddhism, including Zen, but also many other forms, Vajrayana Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism. When the Mahayana arose, it had a sectarian dilemma on its hands, right? Like, how is this new practice legitimate? And so it came up with many sectarian arguments for why this was real Buddhism, right? And even though the Buddha didn't teach this, or, you know, at least not according to the canon. So one of the terms that Mahayana would use is Hinayana. So Mahayana meaning ayana is a vehicle, and Mahayana meaning great vehicle, and Hinayana being small vehicle. So Mahayana would look at these, you know, the forms of Buddhism which were trying to stay true to what the Buddha taught, and saying that's the small vehicle. We have now brought you the great vehicle with these new teachings, including the Bodhisattva ideal and, you know, cosmic bodhisattvas, radical non-duality, teachings of emptiness and Buddha nature. So we carefully do not use the term Hinayana to mean Theravada, right? We do not equate those. We have a much more, like, we're ecumenical, like, we're not going to call other faith traditions, you know, Christian, you know, Judaism, Islam, any Baha'i, anything. Like, we're not going to say that's the small vehicle, right? So we certainly wouldn't do that to Theravada either. But we can use this term in the way that it was originally used, in the sense that a small vehicle, the small vehicle practice, is about the small self, if you will. It's about the self, my practice. All of our practices can be engaged in a Hinayana way or a Mahayana way. That is true of all. Like, I have my 10 fields of Zen practice. I'm going to be leading the fall Tuesday groups or Tuesday classes on. And so bodhicitta, you know, the mind that seeks the way, can be you know, the mind that seeks the way and says, I want to make positive changes, I want to live a better life, I want to, you know, overcome my anger, and I want to do these things. And, you know, so in a way, that's a Hinayana approach to it. So it's not meant to be disparaging. And the Mahayana way is, you know, more difficult to put your finger on. Maybe, you know, gratitude for the mind that seeks the way arising, and not even looking at it as something that we possess or are responsible for, nurturing it. Zazen, similarly, we could, you know, sit zazen for a purpose. We can sit zazen to reduce our stress. We can sit zazen to get insight into ourselves. We can, you know, we're using this as a tool to, you know, become a better person, live a better life. And the Mahayana way of, you know, sitting zazen with no gaining idea whatsoever. So the take-home message today is that our practice, and this is something my own teacher and teachers taught me, all of our practices. So our practice includes both Hinayana and Mahayana practice. So it's like Mahayana did not throw out or reject what came before. It added to it, and it added depth to it. So it's a little bit like, you know, Old Testament, New Testament, right? It's like you don't throw out what came before, even if maybe you don't focus on it a lot, but it is something that is honored. Hinayana is not petty or selfish practice. In fact, it is necessary in a central part of bodhisattva practice. Hinayana practice, though, is the, you know, different ways you can say it. You might say that it's a relative or dependent dimension aspect of our practice, predicated on the idea of a separate self, of causation, of development, of, you know, growth over time, enlightened versus deluded, free versus at the mercy of our karma. Mahayana practice is about transcending dualities, self and other, enlightened and deluded, past and future. It's about awakening here and now to our true nature and the nature of reality. Reality with a capital R, boundaryless, vast, luminous, not separate. So an example, wonderful example of how Hinayana practice can be like beautiful and generous and like consistent with bodhisattva practice is the Metta Sutta. So, you know, we chant this. This is in our chant book. And this is a Pali Canon Sutta. This is a Theravadin Sutta. This is what the Buddha said. And so it really describes, I think, you know, our aspirations, how we would like to be, what we would like to become. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties. I always think of that as, it's not about not having duties. It's about not feeling so burdened by them and stuff, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. And they wish in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. So they have unconditional goodwill toward all beings. They don't despise any being in any state. With a boundless heart, they cherish all living beings, freed from hatred and ill will, free from drowsiness. That would be nice. One should sustain this recollection, not holding to fixed views, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires. Now, and freed from all sense desires, not in the sense of like not appreciating or enjoying, but freed from, you know, the desire to grasp and cling and feeling miserable and empty if we don't get what we want. So this is, you know, a beautiful thing. This is what we want to become. And then the kind of Hinayana version of how, read, this is a from the Dhammapada, one of the oldest texts of the Buddha's words. He's talking about the Eightfold Path. The best of paths is the Eightfold Path. The best of qualities is dispassion. And the best among gods and humans is the one with eyes to see. This is the path for purifying one's vision, There is no other. Follow it, you'll put an end to suffering. This is the path I have proclaimed, having pulled out the arrows. It is up to you to make strong effort. Buddhas merely tell you how. Following the path, those absorbed in meditation will be freed from Mara's bonds. Mara's the deity of the realm of desire. All things are impermanent. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. All created things are suffering. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. All things are not self. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. Watchful in speech and well restrained in mind, do nothing unskillful with your body. Purify these three courses of action, speech, body, speech, and mind. Fulfill the path taught by the sages. Wisdom arises from spiritual practice. Without practice, it decays. Knowing this two-way path for gain and loss, conduct yourself so that wisdom grows. Cut down the forest of desire, not trees. From the forest of desire, fear is born. Having cut down both the forest and the underbrush, monks, be deforested of desire. As long as even the slightest underbrush of desire is not cut away, for that long the mind is bound like a suckling calf as is to its mother. Destroy attachment to self as you would an autumn lily in your fist. Cultivate the path to peace, the nirvana taught by the well-gone one. So in our practice, you know, we have our kind of New Testament way of saying these things, but many of these things are there. Working on ourselves through mindfulness, through self-awareness, working on our negative habits, cultivating the perfections, you know, generosity, ethical behavior, patience, diligence, meditation, and wisdom, kind speech, beneficial action. So again, this Hinayana practice is not selfish. I mean, it could be kind of self-absorbed, but so what about the Mahayana aspect of our practice? So a 12th century Chan monk, I've just been recently introduced to his writings, Da Hui. He was a Chan teacher. And we have, and so he was, 1089 to 1163. So all close to 1,000 years ago. Is that right? 900 years ago, whatever. He ended up, he corresponded a lot with students, and somehow we ended up with like the letters. So this is one of the very rare texts that old, which are just really practical, right? It's not like the, you know, some lofty poetic teachings or whatever. It's, or, you know, inscrutable koans or something. It's like just practical stuff. So this is I'll just read a little bit from this letter. This is from Vice Minister Zhang to Da Hui. So he explains that, you know, he had heard about Da Hui and heard he was a great teacher. So he's writing to him. From the time I was a child, I have this. So this is the layman writing to Da Hui. From the time I was a child, I have aspired to the way. seeking guidance from wise teachers on this matter. However, since turning 20 and reaching the age of majority, I have been occupied with family life and official duties, and thus unable to devote myself fully to Chan practice. To this very day, I have been squandering my time in this manner. Although I am now advanced in years, I have learned nothing, a source of constant shame and regret. Nevertheless, my determination to seek the way and aspiration for the truth are not based on frivolous notions. The way I see it, should I fail to awaken, then that's that. But having set out to awaken, I must strive to attain the very same place realized by the ancient masters, the realm of ultimate repose. My determination to do this has never lapsed for an instant, but I recognize that I have not been sufficiently focused in my efforts. One could say I am great in aspiration, but slight in ability. It's just like a letter that pretty much any of us could have written, right? So he says, fortunately, I have now fulfilled all my family obligations and am able to live at leisure, free of encumbrances. This is the time to apply the whip to myself and revive my original aspiration. I only regret that I have not been able to receive your personal guidance. I have already described the misspent years of my life. Please look into my mind and provide me with detailed instruction and advice. How should I practice in daily life? I wish to accord directly with the original ground and to avoid straying down side paths. So Dahui writes back. I have read in your letter how you sought the guidance of excellent teachers from the time of your childhood until entering government service. During your middle years, you were unable to focus on practice owing to the demands of the civil service examination, family life, official duties, as well as to the influence of deluded views and habits. You regard this departure from Chan practice as a great failing. And being keenly aware that none of the empty illusions in this ephemeral world brings true happiness, you are now determined to thoroughly investigate the great cause of the Buddha's appearance in the world. All of this brings great satisfaction to me. I advise you not to fault yourself too much. As an official, you naturally had to work for your salary to support yourself. And as a layman, you couldn't avoid examinations, marriage, and government duties. That such small faults have caused you such anxiety is precisely because you have served wise mentors through the eons from beginningless past and have become deeply imbued with the fragrance of prajna, wisdom. Even the wise and the saintly could not have avoided those things you regard as great failings. Just realize that these failings are unreal illusions and not the ultimately real Dharma. Turn your mind toward the gate of awakening and refresh yourself by washing away the stains of defilement with the wisdom water of prajna. Cut your present thought off completely and don't continue successive thoughts. This is sufficient. You needn't torment yourself over the past or concern yourself with the future. Having seen that your faults are empty illusions, you will know that the creation of karma is also illusion, that karmic retribution is illusion, that deluded thought is illusion, that delusion itself is illusion, that past, present, and future are all illusion. If today you see your error, this will be the illusory medicine that cures your illusory illness. When the illness is cured and the medicine is no longer necessary, you will be the same person you were before. The notion that there is a special awakened you, a special dharma to be awakened to, is the view of heretics and demons. You should just think deeply on this. Press on resolutely in this way in your sitting meditation, and always keep in mind the two koans, Mount Sumeru and Drop It. These are two koans that he was working on that don't really make any sense. Just proceed steadfastly from right where you are. It does no good to worry over what has happened before or to engage in thought, as these will immediately block the way. Similarly, simply make the following great vow before the Buddhas. May my resolve be firm and never falter. With the aid of the Buddhas, may I encounter a wise mentor, and at a single word, immediately leave the cycle of birth and death and attain supreme awakening. May I succeed to the wisdom life of the Buddhas and thereby repay my debt for their infinite benevolence. Do this, and in time you will, without fail, attain awakening. So another version of this two aspects of our practice thing is gradual and sudden enlightenment. Some of you will have heard that. That was kind of a debate in China, you know, like, is it a, because really the view of original Buddhism was that, you know, we had lifetimes of work we needed to do, that it was like, we all know, right? Like the greed, hate, delusion, you know, that runs deep, and that we just life after lifetime, we needed to purify our karma and, you know, get to a saintly place where then we wouldn't be reborn. So it was very much a gradual thing. But then, you know, it's in maybe before China, but certainly like Mahayana starts to say, essentially, you know, when we talk about dukkha, we talk about dissatisfactoriness as being wishing things would be other than they are. That's something we can drop like that in this moment. And that much of our suffering comes from not seeing how things really are, not seeing how things really are, not acting in accord with how things really are. And that even though it takes a lot of practice to, like, what do we say, the shift in perspective, which really allows us to see this other aspect of reality clearly, happens kind of by accident. But through our practice, we make ourselves accident prone. It's another way to put it. So like we do our practice, and yet, you know, this is why what Dahui is talking about. This is why our Zazen practice is the way it is, right? We are trying to sit and really, really let go and embody what he's talking about, to not be trying to change anything or fix anything or figure anything out, but to come home to our true nature. I don't know about you, but I sure love this paragraph. Having seen that your faults are empty illusions, you will know that the creation of karma is also illusion. Karmic retribution is illusion. Deluded thought is illusion. Delusion itself is illusion. If today you see your error, this will be the illusory medicine that cures your illusory illness. And yet when we meet, there is a tension in our practice. As soon as we start talking about this, And we don't feel like all of this is illusion, then there's something we don't see, and there's something we need to awaken to. So then what the, you know, like, I mean, he says at the end of the section I read, do this and in time you will without fail attain awakening. So it's like, the truth itself, you know, there is no one there, you know, all of these things that he's saying are true. And yet to get there, then we have to kind of move back out into Hinayana territory, right? Then we talk about ourselves and our practice and someday and development and all that. But I think it's helpful to keep in mind these two aspects. I mean, I find it helpful anyway to keep in mind these two aspects of our practice and not try to pit themselves against each other. Simply taking that kind of absolute Mahayana view where, like, you know, there is no karmic repercussions. We know that doesn't go to good places, right? That is not the point. And actually in the next letter, Dahui talks about kind of the Zen sickness, right? And, like, you know, jolting yourself out of that, just clinging to emptiness. But for me, if it was only Hinayana practice, I would feel, I'd be grateful that at least you have some kind of practice, you know, which alleviates some suffering and helps you change some habits and whatever. But I also would feel a lot of discontent, I guess, and despair, because it's just like, this project is going to take forever. And I've been working on it for so hard, so long. And what do I have to show for it, right? Like, it's not. So the beautiful thing is that the more that we have this sense of the illusory nature of all of this, the easier it is, or the wiser we can be when we are doing the Hinayana aspect of our practice. Because we're not, you know, it's not a self-improvement project anymore, right? It's not a like, I gotta, you know, okay, cool. Still, I probably should try to be a little less irritable when I get stressed, right? Like, but it becomes a kind of, yeah, and it takes on a very different tone. So let's see. There's more I can say, but maybe I will open it up there for any comments or questions or reflections. Jessica.
I really needed to hear that letter today. So
thank you.
And I mean, everything about it, I was in tears. And the part about you're not going to evolve into some special elevated Dharma person. No, you're just going to be the same you. It was all really great. So could you hold up the book so I can see the title?
Yes. So this is Dahui's
letter.
And it's this just came out in like 2024. The previous like translation, which was recommended to me, is like an Oxford University Press book, which is hard to get, and it's like $100. So this is a good find.
Good translator.
Thomas Kirchner, Yuho Kirchner, who's Rinzai Zen monk and translator. Darian.
I'm just filling in some time. But I do appreciate the talk, and I am very interested in that book. But something Jessica said reminded me of something that happened here a long time ago. And it was a Tuesday night. I don't need to name names, but there was a couple here. I know you remember them. I forget their names, but one, they were young, and one of them would dance with fire. Do you remember her? I cannot remember her name. Where's, do you remember her? And her, the guy she came with, they were married, I think. And he was the really tall guy that had a very rough life. Anyway, don't know why I'm even, well, I mean, anyway, when Jessica said, reiterated what was in that letter that you read about, you're not going to be some truly enlightened, blazing, person, you're just going to be yourself. You had given a talk. I can't, we never could remember what you were saying on Tuesday night. We always say it was a really great talk, but I can't remember what she said. Anyway, but you were giving a talk, and a minute before 9 o'clock, you said, now you realize that you're not going to change, or you're still going to be the same person. And there was an uproar. And I can't remember what I said, but I spoke up in vehement disagreement about how I felt I had changed. And the girl who was the fire dancer said, yeah, that's right, what she said. But I get it now. But it's at least the guy who wrote the letter, this who started that conversation, have been practicing for a while. But if you have not been practicing for a long time, and you're trying to endure the grueling exercise that is zazen, or that it can be, it's hard to hear that. You mean after all this, I'm not going to change? What are you saying? Anyway, that's what that reminded me of. I don't know if that helped anyone, but.
It's you know, I think it's compassionate to include both aspects in our practice for that very reason, right? That kind of we need some encouragement that we can actually change our behavior and our habits and what have you. And that certainly happens. What I heard was, so I should make a little disclaimer about Dotway. He has a lot of negative stuff to say about silent illumination or shikantaza. He is a hardcore Rinzai guy. Okay, so just be forewarned if you do decide. I mean, there's something though we should keep in mind that throughout the history of Chan and Zen, like the kind of silent illumination school and the koan schools, the hardcore Rinzai, Linji, like they're medicine for each other. They never existed independently. They comment on each other. There's Soto Zen, Chodong teachers who said like that's stupid koans, like so each one is teaching as fresh as they can. And one of the things that I was hearing was that Dahui, the time that he was teaching was like in China, other than perhaps climate change, the time in China was like made what we're experiencing right now like a walk in the park. Like two-thirds of China's population had been killed in strife or war or famine, and like just all. So like it was a time for no bullshit, right? There's no th that's his approach was kind of like there's no time for just handholding and like a slow self-improvement project here, right? This is like wake up. So, I mean, that just take that for what it is. And somebody did ask this, that was the very first letter in this book, so, or in this collection. Ruth Ann, do you have something?
I just wanted to say that for something written 1,000 years ago is so timely for us now, I feel. And we can get stuck on words and feel we have to be in the exact right spot rather than forgetting the ease and the don't know mind. And thank you. I wasn't in tears, but I very much appreciated this.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. Cedar.
Katie.
Oh, Cedar and then Katie. I saw her first.
Just want to make a short comment about being the same person as your wise self has arisen, the same wise self that was there before, but now it's uncovered.
Yeah, you are the same in the, I mean, to me that like, yeah, you're not the same in that, you know, the hopefully the, you know, our reactivity, our sad self-centered delusions, like a lot of that kind of stuff really can get worked out, but that's in a way that's like that's something that's it's like an inhibition to our true self functioning, right? Our true self, you know, feels comfortable and at peace and, you know, open and whatever, versus like, so certainly those things can get worked out. And yet, I mean, I don't know about everybody, but I just held out and still do. Just this hope that like life it will be different. You know, my moment to moment experience will somehow be different. It won't be this, you know, like I'm not in control of my mind or whatever, right? Like that somehow, I don't know what I imagine. If I really, if you'd ask me, like, well, what do you imagine it would be? It's like, I think I'd have to say like that I would walk around 100% conscious of my practice and myself at all times, right? And I have like this really big spiritual view, and I would never get like sucked down into like over being overly wrapped up and concerned in anything, I guess. And you know, when I really contemplate that, I'm like, sounds kind of boring, you know, but it's still that subtle hope that somehow like this is going to be different, and instead kind of seeing how this is it, this is okay, right? So it's not a matter of like waking up and like, all right, your shit life just as it is, that's how it is. Just accept it. I mean, what kind of teaching would that be, right? But rather, your shit life just as it is. It's like, you know, there's nothing missing. Like it is complete. You don't have to look anywhere else. It's really cool that you're you. You know. Katie.
Well, I just read this book called Trying Not to Try, and it kind of talks about it actually is not a Buddhist book, but it's written by a Chinese scholar, a scholar of China. He's British, Edward Slingerland. And that whole thing that you were talking about between Rinzai and Soto, he talks about that, and he says that it's like the two sides of trying not to try. And I mean, so I'm just sitting there going, yes, I just read about that. But anyway, it's really, I found it really interesting because it kind of goes back into the China was kind of consumed by the trying not to try thing. You know, all the different Confucianism, Tao, you know, Confucianism here, trying really hard, Taoism over here, don't try, it's the water, right? But and he basically says that that trying and not trying is like a true paradox. That it's like the one you're always going to run into. It runs through all religions. And I just, you know, it really illuminated that because we live it all the time when we sit down to meditate. And we kind of, I mean, I find myself kind of cycling back and forth.
And I want to go, all right, should I try? Or should I not try?
Right.
I want to be like, I don't need to try.
I'm gonna not try. I'm gonna try for 5 minutes and then I'm gonna not try for 5 minutes. I mean, it's just like, you know, and so find out that it's a true paradox and it's like, well, we can't solve it. And that's maybe a little bit of wisdom or something. But anyway, I just thought it was cool that you were talking about that.
And we can't resolve it, but we can awaken to something by wrestling with it, right? Because it really is about the nature of self. It's about the nature of this life.
Yeah, but it's also sort of based on, like, one is your unconscious and one is your conscious. The trying is your conscious brain. And so they got to work together, right?
There's a part of me that, and this is really where, like, koan work and some of the teachings which just don't, you know, as lovely as, like, you know, original Buddhism was with, like, you know, work on this. And like, it's very straightforward, very down to earth. Like, you know, the Mahayana gets into this kind of, because, where was I going with that? So we want to, right. Okay. Because I noticed recently, I mean, it's like our obstacles and our koans keep arising. We resolve them, we see them. And then, like, when we find ourselves stuck again, and we finally go, like, oh, I don't know, something's up. And then we look and it's like, that again? I mean, you know, but I found myself recently even like, okay, you know, I can get into a, like, oh, I gotta be mindful throughout the day, I gotta do this, I'm gonna, da, da, da. I gotta have this idea about how practice should look, find myself lacking, and I'm like, that's, I know that's not it, right? So I should just let, then part of me is like, what are you talking about? Just like, let go. Don't try. Just let your mind wander all over. Just let habits run your life. Like, you know, like the not, but I realized I was like, try not try. Like, the mind gets into this dualistic thing of just, you know, those are the only options, when actually it's not the case. Right. So the real way, the live way, is not getting stuck in either of those, right? It's actually not trying, letting go, letting be. It's actually hard. We have to actually try. And actually, like, and I think it's one of the things that we recite by Kazon, who says, like, you know, our practice requires effort, but it's not the usual effort.
Yes. Did you raise your hand?
Yeah. Judith.
Go, Judith. Yeah. Judith.
I have this bum knee, guys. I'm trying to
Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. So anyway, just listen to this. You know, I'm not a Buddhist. And so this isn't going to be profound. It's just something that has happened to me with aging. So I don't know if it's happened to me because I come here and I'm aging. So I'm getting help from the Sangha. But it feels to me like you have to have those two things. I mean, I guess that's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Because every single minute of your life, you're having to make decisions. And there's the not wanting to do it and the wanting to do it. And they have to go like this and then come together. And then you decide you can stand up. You should stand up.
Mm-hmm.
Stand up when you're in your 80s and have a bad knee takes effort. So of course you don't want to stand up, but you do want to stand up. So it's, I really, these two are necessary to work yourself into a state to do the right thing, or hopefully you're doing the right thing. And you have to have, it's a balance issue. Okay, that's all I need to say.
And it reminds me that, you know, it's useful, I think, to kind of think about this Hinayana aspect of our practice and Mahayana aspect of our practice. Make sure that we don't get stuck too much in either one, and we honor both and all of that. But then, of course, Zen is about radical non-duality. So we see in which they're not actually separate, right? It's not like you know, to have this profound realization that nothing matters. Yeah, you also should clean up your life. Like they're not separate. When you realize you are okay just the way you are, that's not like a static thing, right? It's like you got good enough, right? It's your every moment effort is part of that picture. Your trying, your aspirations are all part of that, which is okay. And then we get even deeper into, you know, whatever it is that we decide to do, exploring who does that. Who decides? Who speaks? Who sits? Where is that coming from? We just go around with the assumption, like we got our little story about ourselves that we're like, oh, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that. But if we really look closely, it's really much more of a mystery, right? Who walks, who bows, who eats, who laughs. Any burning last few minutes left? Okay, then we'll end there. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna arahita.
Thank you, Danielle. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.